Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Lost Christmas Podcast. Christmas is the theme, and on this podcast, I explore the ins and outs of the holiday. Here you'll find history, folklore, mythology, recipes, stories, and tales from across the globe, and so much more. My name is Jeff, and I absolutely love Christmas. I'm so glad that you're joining today. Each episode has a different topic or two, diving deeply or shallowly into it as I share what I learn about the history of Christmas. At the end of the episode, you'll hear a short summary of the story from The Lost Years of Santa Claus, a book that explores the missing chapters in the life of the person we know as Father Christmas, St. Nicholas, Santa Claus, and by many other names. Each story is broken into two or three parts, so be sure to listen to each episode to hear the whole story. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. I'm super excited for this episode. We are nearing Christmas, the day itself, the big day that everybody looks forward to, at least in my Western calendar that I'm using. If you're on the Eastern calendar, you've still got, about 2 weeks left. So enjoy your time. But for the rest of us, that'll be Epiphany. So for today, we are going to talk about another ancient tradition. I love learning about these and kind of where they come from, what they celebrate, and how it ties into our kind of modern sensibilities and modern traditions, how it's fed forward, and what the importance is. So we are going to talk about the Rauhnacht or Rauhnächte. And so you might be asking, okay, Jeff, this sounds interesting. And if you're thinking this could be related to Rauhklaus or Rufklaus, you are likely correct because this is talking about the rough nights. If you're using the plural, which is Rauhnächte, or I've heard Rauhnachten, but I don't think that's correct. So I'm not a German expert or a Central European language expert, so feel free to correct me. But the Rauhnacht is rough night or smoke night, wild night, or kind of difficult night. It's a term that comes from Central European folklore, particularly in the Germanic regions, kind of Germany, Austria, North and Central Europe. And it commonly is associated with a series of nights. These nights are like a throughout the winter, late in the what we call the calendar year, that are traditionally considered to be highly magical and mystical. They're associated with lots of customs and superstitions, mythology, and rituals. So let's talk about the Rauhnächte. So Rauhnächte typically occurs around the end of December, typically starting around the solstice, and it lasts through the beginning of January, our January calendar. So it's about, I'd say about 12 days, 11 to 12 days. It encompasses dates that now include the winter solstice and Christmas and New Year's. The exact number and timing of the Rauhnächte really is very regionally dependent and historically. So even within specific regions, the different subcultures within those regions could have different days. But typically they do include Christmas Eve and Epiphany in those dates. Not always. And by Epiphany, I'm talking about January 6th. Christmas Eve, I'm talking about December 24th in the Western calendar that we use right now. Where does it come from? So Rauhnächte is rooted in ancient pagan traditions and beliefs. It likely predates Christianity in the area. And it typically, what I've seen is that it originated from the lunar calendar system, which for those that don't know, the lunar calendar has about 354 days for a year. And so these days were the ones that fell outside of the normal cycle of months for the lunar year. So what do I mean by lunar year? Well, that just means a full cycle through all the different phases of the moon as we travel around the sun. So that a lot of cultures use the moon as a means of tracking time and days and seasons. So this makes a lot of sense. And the 12 days or 11 days, depending on how you're looking at it. And that's why I say that's very regionally dependent, because it really depends on kind of how you're tracking things. But so Rauhnacht, these rough nights, didn't fit into their calendar system. So really interesting, I find, that this lines up with... Anyway, I think you can dive in and fall down this rabbit hole all you want. But it's really, really interesting. As I said, Rauhnacht can translate into like rough nights, but it can also be like nights of smoke, and it can suggest a warding off of evil spirits and a time of chaos. It could also refer to like hairy nights, which to me, this is where you're getting into the Rauhklaus or Rauhklaus, which is rough Nicholas, and kind of, I think, so to me, I'm going to go off on kind of my own Christmas historical tangent here a little bit, and I think that Rauhklaus is kind of an adaptation of St. Nicholas when the Christianity and those traditions entered this area and started to pervade a lot of those winter traditions. They wanted to blend a little bit, and so they would bring in Nicholas, but it was rough Nicholas or hairy Nicholas or fur Nicholas. that would come in and kind of combine these two traditions of St. Nicholas and the Raumnacht. That's my personal opinion. You can take it or leave it. It's totally fine. But when referring to the hairy knights, it could also refer to a lot of wild mythical creatures that are active during this period. If you listen to the show, you know that I love the monsters and these kind of traditions and these creatures and the mythology that happens. So, so that's kind of a high-level background. Let's talk about some of the traditions of Raumnacht, because I find this stuff to be super, super interesting. So, the days are kind of broken up and the traditions are kind of broken up into broad categories. There's the protection from evil, there's divination and fortune telling or future telling, there's festive gatherings and partying, and then there's quiet contemplation. So we're just going to go kind of one by one, and I'll mix and match all of these also. But protection from evil. So a lot of times they would burn fragrant herbs and incense. They would smudge the house with sage. Jeff, what does smudging mean? Does that mean like rubbing ash? Well, it can be. It could also be kind of like walking through and, waving the sage and other herbal and very fragrant herbs and spices as you're burning them through the house to clear any evil spirits or malevolent spirits that exist. You also leave offerings of food and drink to these spirits, which were really common practices that helped ward off negativity and malicious beings. All the way back, if you're looking, even going to, Iceland and you have the Tomte or any other kind of, small creatures or elves or spirits that you would talk about, it's kind of a bartering system where they leave you alone for a while and you leave them some food and drink, which could last them. Anyway, I find that really, really interesting, and this is a really cool kind of reference point to where a lot of this came from. So divination. Raumnacht was considered this time where, the veil of worlds thinned between the spectral and the spiritual realm and the, corporeal realm, and it allowed you glimpses into the future or the past. Traditional methods like lead pouring and throwing dice or lead pouring, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, but and dream interpretation were used to predict the coming year. So they would, cast dice or bones, and they would interpret dreams that people had. And a lot of this was incorporated during this, burning of fragrant herbs and incense also. And like I said, it's because of the belief of the thinning of the veil between the different realms. This is interesting to me, because a lot of times, even currently, protection from evil, people say a lot of Christmas prayers, they do special traditions, they go to more church services. Christmas, Easter, and Mother's Day are the most common days for churchgoers in the United States, at least. So Christmas time definitely makes sense. Divination and future telling. Divination more like, I see this as more like prayers and well wishes, and but also there's a lot of common traditions still existing because of all the cold. We're stuck inside and we're trying to avoid any kind of bad weather, foul weather, any potential monsters that are outside. So this is really cool to me. Next we have festive gatherings. Wow, that sounds super familiar. Christmas parties, anybody? Or holiday parties? Winter parties? In some regions, this was Raumnacht is a time for community celebrations, wearing masks, they have masked dances, which I've talked about Mary Lude quite a bit, but there's other traditions very similar to this. There's the Grilla or Gryla masks, there's witch masks, there's horse masks, there's all sorts of things. They would gather, they would dance, they would tell stories, they would sing, they would feast together. And to me, this is the best. This is the best. Festive gatherings, you celebrate together, you have a sense of community, and you reflect on the previous year. So that's where I'm going to tie into this last one, quiet contemplation. Other interpretations of Raumnacht or Raumnacht emphasize really a period of introspection and reflection and over the past year and preparing for the year ahead. Thinking about what you did well, what you could do better, maybe failings you had, trying to reimagine those things in a positive light. I really like this. This also reminds me of a lot of other traditions that I'll just leave it at that, where we're talking about going through a series of days and thinking about how we can reflect on family or our futures, our careers, all of those things, and how we can improve them in the coming year. Yeah, you know, so when we talk about the veil also between these realms, there's a belief that spirits and ghosts were roaming freely. Again, if you missed the episode on the Wild Hunt, please go back and check that out. That's a really, really common common kind of Northern European and Central European belief, and they call it different things, but it's all very, very similar. Yeah, well, I'm going to transition because that's an excellent segue, Jeff. I'm going to transition. So some of the Rau Nocta, they have, in some of these places, they have specific nights and meanings, and it could be groups of days or groups of nights. Also, I think it's important to remember, at a lot of ancient cultures, they measured the day by nightfall to nightfall rather than sunup to sunup like we do. So when we talk about nights or days, we're talking about the same thing, just like framed differently. So when we're looking at Rau Nocta in different regions, sometimes they would group the days into three or four at a time. They would have like four groups of three or three groups of four, and they would go through these specific things like the protection from evil, the divination, the gatherings, or quiet contemplation. So they would have a set of days dedicated to those, to each of those. Some traditions in Rau Nocta even assigned to like each night to a specific month of the lunar coming year, with the belief that weather or events on that night are going to predict what happens in the month and, you know, coming forward, and they would track this and monitor this, and I find that really, really cool too. The trying to interpret and make sense of what our world is doing is just, to me, it will never not be interesting, kind of how ancient cultures do it, how we currently do it, how every culture believes that what they're doing is right and has been right forever. I mean, so let's take our weather system presently. Beyond 3 days, just, I'm going to do a little math for you here, but or explain a little bit, but beyond 3 days, your weather system is basically just an aggregate of like the last 100 years on those days, and that's basically what they're putting out for you. So if you're looking beyond 72 hours for a weather forecast, you're guessing. So if it's a hurricane or whatever, a large storm, then what they're doing is they're looking at, hey, storms that have presented like this previously, this is where they're going. It's not actually basing it off like the most current data, specifically after 3 days. And that's just a statistical thing where there is just like a probability that just, you know, just shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. So if you're looking at weather beyond 3 days to try and figure out what's going to happen, you know, at Christmas and you're on the 18th or whatever, you just give up because you're just guessing at that point. Or just look at last year and try and guess from there. But within 3 days, there's a reasonable set of accuracy, and that's because we can see these weather systems. So I say that all only going back to trying to explain the world around us and predict the future events. That's all I'm saying. To me, our weather system is just a more advanced and scientific version of that, but still very flawed and has a lot of volatility that we don't specifically usually include. So, okay, diatribe over. Going to continue. When the veil is thinned, not only do we have closeness with a lot of these evil spirits and monsters, but we have connection with our ancestral spirits too, according to many Rau Nocta traditions. It's a time to honor and remember our ancestors. It's believed that the spirits of dead family members can be present during these nights, much like the Dia de los Muertos around the beginning of November in a lot of Central American cultures. And so people might set out light, they might light candles or set out food or perform specific rituals and songs and dances to honor their family. I love this. Basically every culture honors their dead in a very like appreciative way and a very ceremonial way, and I really like that. So there's also prohibitions and taboos. There's like things that are outlawed during Rau Nocta. So spinning was typically not allowed, spinning of yarn. It was believed this would anger the spirits. I had an episode not too long ago about creatures from the, you know, so I think it was my second or third episode about Christmas time monsters. So spinning is very common that this is brought up kind of across Europe. Doing laundry was prohibited because the flapping of the clothes on the line could invite malevolent spirits into the home. That's a first. I hadn't heard that before, but I find that to be pretty funny. And then my favorite, Wild Hunt mythology. So the Rau Nocta is closely, like very closely associated with the myth of the Wild Hunt. And the ghostly procession in the sky led by figures could be Odin, could be Woden, could be a variety of characters have led the Wild Hunt. if you're listening to the story, maybe another character that you might have heard of, or other legendary figures from different regions, just depending on kind of where you're at specifically. There's different figures, and could be male, could be female, could be monstrous, could be animal, could be all different things. But it is believed that the Wild Hunt is most active during these Rau Nocte, sweeping across the skies, collecting souls of the dead, sometimes of the living, adding them to their numbers, and raising an army to eventually come back and take over. So food and feasting after, you know, after being scared to death by all of these wild animals and creatures, sometimes we want to celebrate and we want to have food and forget that we're terrified of what's going on outside. And so a lot of traditions call for fasting and abstaining from certain foods, but that also means that you're celebrating with lots of other foods. Maybe it's unleavened bread. Maybe it's you're not eating red meat. Maybe you're not eating eggs or something. There's all sorts of fasting, and different days would account for different fasts where you like abstain from a certain food or a drink. Others involve the special preparation of meals in a very specific way, like you're cooking a certain fish in a certain seasoning in a certain manner, and then you serve it at a certain time. And that's mostly because foods have specific meanings and symbolic meanings that are shared with family and friends, or it connects to kind of past loved ones, or connects to the world outside. Could be a month of the year type of thing. So food and feasting is always going to be important. That's globally, that is one of the most tied together things that we have, is food and feasting. We get together and we break bread together, proverbially, not specifically. Everybody doesn't eat bread. But that's why I love this, is you see these commonalities across cultures. Right now I'm talking about Central and Eastern Europe, but I don't think anyone here could name that's listening. Or that's not listening, could name a culture where feasting and togetherness for food is not important, or, you know, reverence of the past year and moving forward isn't important or isn't thought about at all. So I love this. I love seeing this because it just continues to reaffirm that we are like so much more connected than we like to give ourselves credit for. Dream interpretation, I talked about this a little bit, but dreams during the Rau Nocte were often given special attention. They were believed to be prophetic or contain important images and messages. Funnily enough, growing up, I had the same dream, like around Christmas, the couple days before Christmas, for like 4 years in a row. I mean, we're talking the exact same dream, and I won't get into the imagery of it, but it like still terrifies me to this day. And it wasn't even as like when I talk about it, it doesn't sound scary at all, but like when I was dreaming it, it was horrifying and terrifying and scared me to death. And I would always wake up right at the exact same moment. So haven't had it in about 25, 30 years, but nonetheless, it stuck with me. So that makes sense. I think sometimes when you have a specific time of year where you're emphasizing certain things, you know, like for me, it was emphasizing Christmas time. So I was constantly focused on the same things. And so of course my brain's going to continue to function that way. Nonetheless, dream interpretation, very prophetic. There's a lot of books about interpreting dreams, and whether you're talking about like modern day psychology or you're talking about like historic or new age beliefs also, there's a ton of ways to interpret dreams. So do so at your own risk, up to you. Nightly practices. So at night, like I said, night is kind of like the beginning of the next day, if that makes sense, in a lot of cultures. So I talked about smudging. Or rocking, and that is the smoking of houses and stables with incense and blended herbs, and this just drives out spirits and brings blessings. This is still very common across the U.S., so in case you're not familiar, this is what you're doing when you're lighting a candle that smells good. It's the exact same process, just kind of modernized. So most of you guys know this already, but or you've tied it together at this point. But yeah, that's really what you're doing, is you're however you want to interpret it, you're making your house smell good, which is like inviting and warming. It's kind of the same thing. Fortune telling. So we talked about this already. Yeah, it's super, super important. And it would happen basically every day. They would basically go and ask about what you dreamed about. Or they would say, oh, this looks ominous for you for next year. So maybe, you know. There's traditions where there's like the young men's day and the young woman's day, and where, you know, they would get foretold whether they're going to find their partner, their life partner for the, anyway, all sorts of things can happen there. You know, there's rituals and customs that could be like specific decorations, or you perform a special act or a dance, that have protective or beneficial effects. They could bring prosperity or ward off evil spirits. All of these customs and traditions are super, super critical and important. Silence and reflection is another one, and I talked about this already, but I mean, if you haven't already this Christmas season, take a minute and just like sit quietly and like think over the last year and where you've come from and where you're headed, and just reflect on, you know, kind of how blessed we are and how lucky we are to live in a modern day world. There's plenty of challenges that previous societies didn't have, but we also don't have to worry constantly about like the things that previous societies had. So that's what I like to think about. And then folklore and stories, which is my wheelhouse, you know, they would go and they would share tales of ghosts and spirits and supernatural beings, of the leshies in the forest or the wardens of the forest or the dire wolves or dire boar or bear or the wild hunt, and all these evil spirits and supernatural beings. And sometimes they're evil and sometimes they're not, and sometimes they're just, you know, crazy and on a whim. So but in modern times, a lot of these beliefs and customs have faded, and the Rau Nocte is not quite celebrated in the exact same way, but it still holds a lot of significance in many areas. And some of these traditions are maintained as part of each region's cultural heritage. So contemporarily, some of the more superstitious aspects have faded, but people observe these same nights in various ways. So sometimes like they sit and they have personal reflection, or, you know, if we're talking like Sweden, we could talk about Hygge and how this could, it's obviously not, I'm not saying that, my Swedish friends, I'm not saying that this is an interpretation of a Rau Nocte. It's not. I'm just saying that it's a very similar time of personal reflection, relaxation, and a feeling that you get, that is like, just, it's Hygge. That, I mean, I don't know how to say it any other way. If you're not sure what that is, Hygge. Plenty of great books out there, plenty of great candles. Just go do yourself a favor and start to experience Hygge for yourself. But people would, you know, people still modern day, they set intentions for next year, setting goals for the year, which a lot of these traditions go back thousands of years. And so, and then they enjoy festive atmosphere. So they would bring greenery inside to remind them of the coming year. They would celebrate with feasts and food and set out special food for a special, special creatures that would come by, and negotiating for either gifts or for just to be left alone. This is just so interesting. The pre-Christian roots might not resonate with everybody for Rau Nocte, but the themes of introspection, connection with nature and the world around us, celebrating the cycles of the year and the seasons, it holds appeal for tons of people, whether you are of whatever your faith or belief is. I find that Rau Nocte's themes still kind of hold true in a lot of way. Some of the traditions are enjoying like a resurgence in popularity, celebrated by individuals who are looking for like alternative, meaningful ways to observe the winter solstice and New Year's period. If you listen to this, I'm a Christmas podcast. I celebrate Christmas, but I find a lot of these really, really interesting. So these ancient pagan traditions and how they've influenced us in like a Christian society. So, or in a, as people of a Christian faith in a broader society that's very diverse and full of, you know, all sorts of beliefs. So to wrap it up, I guess like Rau Nocte, it's like this really fascinating blend of pagan traditions, and now it's being blended with some of the more Christian, like modern Christian influences. And it, you know, has this deep connection of like nature, the spiritual world, rhythms of agricultural life, and this like flow that we have of like harvest and planting and growth. And it just offers a window into how our ancestors understood and coped with the darker, colder times of the year, and how they celebrated this like return of light after the winter. So I hope you guys have enjoyed this. I hope you guys have learned quite a bit about Rau Nocte. I was a little long-winded about this one. Sorry. I find this one to be really, really interesting, and I love it. And if you're sticking around, you are going to hear another story at the end of the story from The Lost Years of Santa Claus. So I'm going to get a drink, and then I'm going to come in and record parts 4 and 5 of Santa Claus and the Curse of the Wild Hunt. Thanks, y'all. All right, everybody, I am back, and I wanted to let you know that I did get a drink. Much to my wife's chagrin, I do mention this, and it's just because I just tend to do a kind of stream of consciousness sort of podcast. I hope you guys enjoy it. If not, let me know, and maybe I can change that. Maybe not. I don't know. Who knows? But I want you to hang on, because we've got a much longer story today. I decided to wrap up this, and because I'm going to try to do a special Christmas Eve episode, kind of a reprisal of my first story from The Lost Years of Santa Claus. The first one that I read to you guys, I'm going to read you guys an edited version all in one, one big long episode. I hope you guys will enjoy it. But thank you guys for listening, and here is parts 5 and 6 of Santa Claus and the Curse of the Wild Hunt. Philaurel, who had secretly continued loving Chris from afar, could not bear to see him imprisoned in such a cruel fate. She knew that she had to find a way to break the curse and free him. Dovgim and Eowyn told her of a prophecy that spoke of 3 enchanted items hidden in dangerous locales, each with the power to undo the forest curse. She must travel to the Cave of Whispers to find the Whispering Stone, a crystal said to hold the secrets of the wind itself. She must also journey to the Enchanted Grove of Timulin, a mystical forest where time seems to stand still, in order to steal the Tears of Dawn, a rare flower said to bloom only at the first light of day. And additionally, she must go to the Labyrinth of Dreams, this magical maze where one's deepest desires and fears both come to life in terrifying and fantastic fashion. There she must find and acquire the Echoing Mirror, a looking glass that reflects only one's true self. Knowing what she must do, she determined that her best path was to attack the Cave of Whispers, then blaze a path to the Enchanted Grove, and finally face her own fears at the Labyrinth of Dreams before attempting to save Chris from the curse. Eowyn and Dovgim reminded her of the curse itself, said only to be broken if a member of the cursed tribe is held by their love through the night into first morning. The pain of words, venom, denial, cold, and finally burning would be present, and she could not let go, lest the curse be made permanent and Chris would be lost forever. Getting into the forest would prove challenging, let alone finding her way to Grilla's magical realm within the forest, but with the help of these 3 items she would obtain, Philaurel was confident she could become a hero she had always felt in her heart that she would be. With determination burning in her heart, Philaurel embarked on her perilous journey. Her first destination was the Cave of Whispers, a dark and treacherous cave known for its eerie echoes. Her emerald cloak fluttering beneath the moonlight, she stood before the gaping maw of the Cave of Whispers, wind laced with 1,000 unseen voices carried through the canyon, chilling her elven skin. Legend spoke of the Whispering Stone, a luminescent crystal within the cave's heart said to hold the secrets of the wind itself, its whispers promising mastery over the very breath of the world. Philaurel, a rogue extraordinaire, craved that power, not for ambition, but for freedom. Years ago, her village was raised by Grilla's Iron Hand Legion, their war machines belching smoke and fear. Philaurel, barely a wisp of a girl then, escaped it with the wind at her back, its whispers guiding her to safety. Now grown into a woman as swift and sharp as a honed blade, she vowed to use the wind secrets to avenge her love against the awful ogre sorceress. The cave's entrance seemed to pulse with an eerie green glow. Taking a deep breath, Philaurel slipped inside. The air grew thick with whispers, a million disembodied voices chattering secrets and warnings. The deeper she ventured, the fainter the moonlight became, replaced by the luminescence of strange moss clinging to cavern walls. Strange shapes, half glimpsed in the shifting light, seemed to mock her from the shadows. Her senses prickled. A low growl echoed from deep within, followed by the clatter of claws on the stone. A monstrous figure, black slick fur with bioluminescent slime, lurched into view. Its eyes, twin malevolent embers, fixated on Philaurel. Her hand instinctively flew to the enchanted dagger strapped to her thighs. The fight was a blur of steel and shadow. Philaurel danced around the creature, her blades biting into its flesh, but its thick hide resisting her blows. Just as she felt her strength falter, she noticed a chink in its armor, a pulsating white orb nestled deep within its chest. With a whispered prayer to the wind god, she launched herself, daggers flashing, and pierced the orb. The creature roared, a sound that shook the very stones of the cave. Then, with a sickening thud, it crumbled to dust. Exhausted but exhilarated, Philaurel pressed on, the whispers now guiding her, the urgency growing. Deeper still, she came upon a cavern bathed in ethereal green light, and there, floating in the center, pulsed the Whispering Stone, a swirling vortex of emerald fire. As Philaurel reached for it, the whispers escalated into a deafening cacophony, 1,000 voices vying for her attention. They offered secrets of power, the ability to summon storms, ride on hurricanes, and breathe life into the wind itself. Yet amidst the clamor, a single voice rose above the rest, soft and familiar, the voice of the wind that had saved her as a child. "Philaurel," it whispered, "power without purpose is a storm without direction. You are not a weapon, but a dancer in the wind's ballet. Seek not control, but to understand." A wave of understanding washed over Philaurel. The true mastery of the wind wasn't in domination, but in partnership. As she touched the stone, the voices subsided, replaced by a single clear note. A melody of wind sang in her soul. It wasn't a weapon, but a song, a promise of understanding, of moving with the wind, and not against it. Leaving the stone untouched, Philaurel emerged from the cave, not as a conqueror, but as a dancer. The wind, whispering secrets only she could hear, embraced her as she walked into the dawn, not with vengeance in her heart, but with newfound freedom, light as a feather on the breath of the world. Off she flew, toward the enchanted grove of Timulin. Laurel, the elf whose emerald eyes held the glint of 1,000 stolen jewels, stood at the edge of the enchanted grove of Timoline. The air shimmered, caught in a perpetual dusk, leaves frozen in mid-flutter, birds etched into the silent flight. Legend whispered of the tears of dawn, luminous flowers that bloomed only at first light, their nectar said to hold immense magic. Tonight, Flora would pluck them, blast the constraints of time. She slipped through a tapestry of stillness, her leather-booted feet silent on the petrified moss. Whispers trapped in the air brushed against her ears, stories of forgotten moments and lost laughter. Deeper she ventured, the air growing denser and shadows stretching out like hungry claws. Then a low growl vibrated the ground, and from the twilight mist emerged a creature sculpted from nightmares. Its fur was spun from moonlight, its eyes twin emeralds burning with stolen time. A Barghest, the legends called it, a scavenger of lost hours. For Laurel's hand flew to the dagger strapped on her thighs, their cold hilts against her skin. The Barghest pounced, a blur of teeth and claws. Floral leaped, dodging the swipe, daggers flashing in the fading light. Steel met fur, sparks spitting, but the Barghest's hide seemed woven from shadows, resisting every bite. Time seemed to warp around them, moments stretching into agonizing slow motion. Suddenly, an idea sparked in Floral's mind, sharp as her blades. With a whispered prayer to the moon elves, she disarmed herself, throwing the daggers into the still air. There they hung, frozen in place like shimmering stars caught in a celestial trap. The Barghest, confused, hesitated. Valora seized the moment, weaving between its frozen claws, her nimble body contorted through the impossible stillness. Reaching its back, she felt a weak point, a sliver of vulnerability nestled among the moonlight fur. With a surge of adrenaline, she dug her fingers in, twisting and pulling. The Barghest howled, a sound ripped from the frozen fabric of time. The forest shuddered, and then, with a deafening crack, the spell shattered. Time resumed its flow, leaves rustling, birds singing, the grove returning to life. The Barghest dissolved into dust, leaving only a whisper of regret in the air. Exhausted but triumphant again, Valoral turned her gaze to the east. A faint rosy glow was painting the horizon, the first blush of dawn. There, nestled amidst the awakened leaves, bloomed the tears of dawn, their petals shimmering with the tears of the newborn sun. Valoral plucked them, their touch a cool solace against her scraped palms. Time may have been her enemy, but in its stillness she had found a moment of perfect fleeting victory. As the sunlight bathed the now alive grove, washing away the last vestiges of dusk, Valoral slipped away, not just with the tears of dawn, but with a newfound respect for the fragile balance of time and the power that can be found in a single stolen sunrise. Valoral stood trembling before the shimmering maw of the Labyrinth of Dreams, her final destination. This wasn't some rickety goblin den or dusty tomb. This was a legend made flesh. A labyrinth where reality itself bent to the whims of your deepest desires and gnawing fears. It was also the only path to the echoing mirror, a looking glass rumored to reflect your truest self, flaws and all. This rogue who navigated shadow like a second skin scoffed at the prospect of mere illusions, yet a tremor, subtle as a butterfly's wing, betrayed the flicker of fear in her heart. Years spent cloaked in a persona, a tapestry woven from stolen jewels and whispered secrets, had left her questioning the face behind the mask. The echoing mirror was a desperate gamble, a last chance to peel back the layers and confront the woman staring back. The portal, like a shimmering mirage born from moonlight, swallowed her whole. She gasped, landing on cobbled streets that stretched under an eternal twilight. Her reflection in the polished stones, usually a mask of cool disdain, wavered, the edges blurring with a vulnerability she'd spent years burying. Whispers, silken and insidious, slithered into her ears, painting dreams of stolen power, bottomless coffers, and love everlasting. Each path shimmered like a beckoning mirage, cloaking deceit in the glittering guise of desire. Floral knew better than to chase phantoms. Her past was littered with the shattered remnants of such folly. She pressed on, the whispers transforming into a cacophony of self-doubt, her past failures echoing in the labyrinthine silence. A treacherous chasm split the path, its obsidian depths promising oblivion. Floral plummeted, her scream swallowed by the void, only to land with a thud in a desolate wasteland bathed in crimson moonlight. A gnarled skeletal tree clawed at the sky, the sole sentinel in this barren purgatory. Then, from the shadows, it emerged. Her own face, warped into a grotesque caricature, wielding twin blades that mirrored her own with twisted, malicious grace. This was her shadow, the embodiment of her deepest fears, the venomous whisper that she was nothing but a monster in disguise. Valoral's fingers instinctively twitched toward her daggers, but she knew brute force would not shatter this illusion. Instead, she disarmed herself again, flinging the blades into the abyss. "I am not defined by my weapons," she declared, her voice echoing in the desolate expanse. "My strength lies in my choices, even the darkness I carry." The shadow faltered, its confidence shaken. Valora pressed on, weaving words of self-forgiveness, acceptance, of the light that still flickered within her soul. Each word chipped away at the illusion, a sculptor revealing the hidden beauty beneath the scarred marble. The crimson sky bled back into a soft twilight, the wasteland dissolving into the labyrinth's familiar path. Finally, with a sigh that seemed to carry the weight of ages, the shadow dissipated, leaving only a wisp of regret to mark its passing. The path led Valora to a crystal cavern bathed in the ethereal glow of a thousand moons, and there, suspended on silver chains, shimmered the echoing mirror. Its surface, a swirling vortex of moonlight, beckoned with a silent promise of truth. Taking a deep breath, Valora stepped forward. Her reflection wasn't the flawless face she'd often imagined, but it wasn't the monstrous vision she'd feared either. It was the face of a woman, scarred, yes, but resilient, her eyes blazing with a defiance tempered by self-compassion. The labyrinth had not granted her immortality, but something far more precious, the unshakable knowledge of who she truly was, darkness and all. Emerging from the portal, blinking in the real-world sunlight, Valora was no longer the same rogue. The echoing mirror had not shown her perfection, but a reflection she could finally accept. The labyrinth had stripped her bare, forced her to confront her demons and claim her true self. In that acceptance, she found a strength that no illusion, no labyrinth could ever steal. It was a strength born not from stolen jewels and whispered secrets, but of facing the darkness within and finding the light that still burned bright. Riding along the wind, her newfound steed, Valora quickly found her way back to this cursed forest, the place where her love was hidden inside and desperate to be saved. The forest edge crackled with an almost palpable sense of malice. Jagged branches like twisting claws reached for the sky, their bark contorted into masks of agony. Leaves whispered ancient curses on the wind, each rustle a chilling portent. Valora clutched the words from the whispering stone, its guiding warmth spreading through her palm and into her heart, a beacon of hope amidst the encroaching gloom. Her heart pulsed, guiding her toward a hidden path, a secret artery snaking through the forest's gnarled veins. She followed the whispers, dodging gnarled branches that seemed to lash out with surprising swiftness, their shadows whispering doubts and fueling her fear. Valora pressed on, the tears of dawn tucked behind her ear, their faint luminescence casting a protective aura around her. Emerging into a clearing bathed in eternal twilight, Valora gasped. Moonlight dripped from the moss-laden branches, weaving an ethereal tapestry against the backdrop of twisted vines that imprisoned ancient oaks and thorny cages. In the heart of the clearing, the source of the curse throbbed, a gnarled oak. Older than time itself, its bark pulsing with a sickly green light that stained the very air she breathed. But at its base, bathed in the pale glow of the tears of dawn, lay a pool of moonlight, its surface shimmering like a portal to another world. Valora took a deep breath, her heart a frantic drum against her ribs. Raising the echoing mirror, she looked not at her reflection, but into a swirling vortex of fear and love. Yet, within that chaotic maelstrom, a single point of resolve, bright as a star, flickered. With that resolute nod, she stepped into the pool. The world dissolved. Valora tumbled through a kaleidoscope of moonlight and shadows, fear clawing at her throat until she landed with a soft thud on dew-kissed grass. The air hummed with magic, moonlight painting a clearing in an ethereal glow. In the center stood a lone willow, its branches weeping silver tears. Beneath it, bound by thorns that pulsed with the sickly green light, knelt Chris. Valora ran to him, her heart a frantic drum. Ignoring the thorns that pricked her skin, she knelt beside him, tears blurring her vision. She recited words she had learned from the whispering stone into his ear, and the tears of dawn's emerald light bathed him in warmth. The thorns writhed, hissing like vipers, snapping and biting at her skin 100 times, but she stayed ever vigilant and refused to let go. Slowly, other trees began to wake, as did the shadows in this dreamlike realm. Shadowy, ghastly souls strode toward her maliciously, but she held on. Vines and branches pulled on her, snakes tore at her skin. Chris, the cursed love of her life, turned cold as ice, his skin and clothing hard and cold, freezing her skin and face with painful, fiery cold blasting from his very aura. Knowing she could not fail, Valora held on for dear life. A cackle of laughter burst through the area, Grilla mockingly laughing in her undisguised ghoulish visage. Time was passing slowly, but the soldiers of the Wild Hunt were unable to break her apart. They could intimidate, hoot, howl, and threaten in any language they desired, but they could not interfere, as she worked so diligently to break this curse. The last fibers of the night sky began to turn blue-green with the coming day, and the final bout of the curse's enchantment took hold. Chris himself burst into flames, setting himself and Valora ablaze, though not damaging Chris in the slightest. Valora gritted through the burning and the pain, dragging Chris toward the pool. With the last bit of her strength and with the first rays of sunlight, she leaned back and pulled him into the pool on top of her. Then they sank, slowly, not on fire, but passion and love burning strongly between the two. Then they crashed out into a copse, gasping for breath, Floral attempting to tend to her wounds. The willows above them wept, its tears not of sorrow, but of cleansing. They washed over Chris, dissolving the thorns, unfurling his still tense muscles. His eyes, the color of summer sky, flickered open, and a smile, like the first bloom of spring, chased away the shadows from his face. They emerged from the copse, hand in hand, the words of the whispering stone, the tears of dawn, and the echoing mirror, both tucked away safely. The whispering wild forest, bathed in the afterglow of their love, seemed to sigh, its gnarled branches loosening their grip, its whispers softening to lullabies, if only for a few moments. For Laurel and Chris walked out of the forest, the rising sun painting the sky in hues of hope. The curse was broken, the forest recovering, if just a bit, and their love, forged in the heart of darkness, shone brighter than any dawn. The darkened and cursed forest, still a mysterious and foreboding place, was continued to be avoided, and is so to this day. And Faloral, the wanted criminal, outlaw, and roguish girl, who dared to defy a curse, became a legend whispered on the wind, a testament to the powers of love, courage, and just a little bit of magic. All right, everybody, I know this was a long one, but I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed the end of Santa Claus and the Curse of the Wild Hunt. As I said, I'm going to try to push out a Christmas Eve episode. I appreciate all of you guys for listening. I hope you have a wonderful day, and I hope you guys are having a wonderful Christmas season. Thanks.
Season to be jolly, fa la 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 la.